You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Yesterday, the people of Tunisia began 3 days of mourning to honor the memory of those who have died in their countrywide uprising. It began December 17th, and in just a few days short of 1 month, the people of Tunisia had toppled the longtime dictator of their country, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. Ben Ali fled the country January 14th, but the people still fill the streets today as the struggle for a democratic Tunisia continues. To examine the significance of these events, I'm joined by Samer Shahata. He is a professor of Arab politics at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. This is at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Samer, to Vancouver Cooperative Radio, and thank you for making yourself available this morning in the midst, I know, of a busy schedule.
You're very welcome.
Many North African countries are ruled by dictators from Egypt to Libya to Algeria to Morocco. Why has Tunisia, that little country nestled between Libya and Algeria, been the first dictatorship to collapse?
Well, it's a very good question, and there isn't an easy, straightforward, non-challengeable answer. I think there are a number of reasons. And then, of course, the question assumes that the other ones will inevitably collapse. We hope they will, but I think that's still uncertain. I think, not necessarily in this order, the first thing that needs to be said is that in Tunisia, of course, we have had a different history of military involvement in politics. The Tunisians gained their independence from France in 1956 as a result of a widespread nationalist movement led by Habib Bourguiba, who was not a military man. So the military has been, and of course, only in 1987, when Zine El Abidine had a coup against Bourguiba, did the military and Mr. Zine El Abidine become the leader of the country. Now, that's very, very different than what we've seen in a number of other countries in North Africa and actually throughout the rest of the Arab world. If we move next door to Tunisia's neighbor, Mr. Gaddafi, Colonel Gaddafi, overthrew the regime in 1969, coming from the military. In Libya's neighbor, Egypt, Mr. Mubarak was an Air Force commander, and he, of course, came after President Sadat, who was also a military figure. So the relationship between the army and politics, I think, is, and the army and power, is significantly different in Tunisia than in many other places. The army was much more professional, much removed from the politics of power and rule. I think that's one thing that's very important. I think the level of corruption and the antipathy towards the dictator and the dictator's immediate family is, of course, similar to many countries in the Arab world and elsewhere, but I think at its height in Tunisia. There was really tremendous antipathy towards not only Ben Ali, but particularly Leila Trabulsi, his wife, his second wife, who was known for outrageous corruption and extending her tentacles and her family's tentacles throughout the Tunisian economy. All kinds of other, I think there are other reasons as well, but those were some of them, certainly.
What are the grievances that have brought the Tunisian people to rebel? You mentioned the corruption of the ruling group. Are there other grievances that really are the motor force of their anger and their desire for dramatic change?
Sure. Well, this was a dictatorship, as you mentioned, and it was actually a dictatorship that was bad, even in comparison to a number of other autocratic regimes in the region. So I would say that there are two primary, you know, reasons if you want to focus on them. One would be kind of economic grievances, and the economic grievances having to do with high levels of unemployment, particularly high levels of youth unemployment, rising inflation, decreasing real wages, largely as a result of Tunisia's neoliberal economic reforms and the superficial or not really deep type of development that Tunisia has sustained over the last 10, 15 years. So that's one aspect of it. And of course, Mohamed Bouazizi, the gentleman who self-immolated himself on December the 17th, who was really the catalyst for all of this, is a perfect example of that, a high school graduate who was forced to sell fruits and vegetables for a living and not really make a significant life for himself and for his family. Very high levels of unemployment. The official figure is 14.7%, but if we look at even World Bank statistics, we'll see very quickly that if you look at segments of the population that are below the age of 30, that increases tremendously, upwards of 20% of the population and so on. So economic factors certainly is very important. And then, of course, politics. This was a regime that makes the Moroccan regime, makes the Algerian regime look quite democratic in comparison, even though they're not democratic. And what I mean by that is that if elections are problematic in Egypt and often fraudulent to some degree, they're always fraudulent in Tunisia and to a much greater degree. If civil society is somewhat regulated and surveilled in a place like Egypt or Morocco, in Tunisia it is completely dominated and surveilled by the state. Many political leaders have been forced out of the country and are in exile, and were in exile until, you know, this occurred in Paris and in London and elsewhere, whereas in Morocco and in Egypt, those regimes tolerate a small space for political dissent and so on. And that possibly made the Tunisian regime more brittle, more unable to withstand the discontent and the street protests that occurred, whereas a regime like Morocco or Egypt or Jordan that has a little bit of space, allows a little bit of breathing room, not certainly enough, might be able to withstand that type of pressure a bit better.
You mentioned the army before and it having a different role than in other North African countries, not being directly a part of the ruling force. And there seems to have been a difference in the response of the soldiers to the uprising. You would see pictures of demonstrators fraternizing with soldiers. And the police, at least until today, seemed to be the most repressive force. But today, I noticed reports in Al Jazeera that the police have joined in demonstrations with the people. Is it that these two repressive forces that most aid agencies use simply are no longer willing to perform that function?
Well, that was certainly the case with the Tunisian army, and that's a very crucial aspect of the story. In early January, at some point, the Army Chief of Staff refused to accept orders to fire on civilian protesters. And that really was a crucial moment in this story, when the regime no longer had the uncontested use of force against civilians. And it produced a fissure, as it were, in the Tunisian regime, and that allowed protests to grow even greater, as protesters knew that it wasn't necessarily the case that they would be repressed by bullets and batons and tear gas, at least by the Tunisian army. Now, that wasn't the case, unfortunately, with the Tunisian security forces, or at least some of them, which were much more part of the Ben Ali regime and used to repress the population and so on. And in fact, in the immediate days after the departure of Ben Ali, there were many reports of confrontations between army units and security forces, actually fighting and firing on each other, and so on. So I think that's definitely part of the story. I think what we saw in Tunisia today, with members of the police force come out and support the revolution and so on, is a recognition, really, by maybe the majority of them, that the Ben Ali regime is over. Of course, not all of them were implicated in the crimes, but the Ben Ali regime is over, and it's a demonstration of their loyalty and faith and solidarity with what's happened. So to demonstrate that they're not, at least the ones who are demonstrating, the bad guys, as it were, and the groups of Ben Ali remnants that are trying to cause trouble throughout the country are different, isolated, a small group, and not representative of the Tunisian police. That's, I think, what the point of the demonstrations were that we saw today.
The Tunisian people are continuing their struggle for a democratic society. Of course, it's a complex question of what mechanisms will lead in that direction. I heard one woman activist who had been imprisoned by the regime and so on calling for a constituent assembly of from the Tunisian people, and it sort of called back to mind things happening in Latin America, in Venezuela, in Bolivia, and Ecuador, where that mechanism has been used. What would you say are the key issues or ideas floating around among the forces of rebellion in Tunisia about how they can achieve a democratic society?
Well, as you pointed out, I think this is the key point of contention right now, with the protesters on the street wanting to be completely rid of anyone who was in power and in politics who was associated with the Ben Ali regime, in the parliament, in government, ministers, and so on. Even if, as they have in the last few days, exited from the party, officially left the party, and so on. Whereas members of government, the acting president, the prime minister, and so on, former members of the Democratic Constitutional Rally, the ruling party, are saying that they have left the party, that there's a separation of the party from the regime, and that they're simply an interim government to get Tunisia to free and fair elections sometime in the future. And this is the debate. I don't think, actually, myself, that that necessarily this is the crucial thing. I think that there is really, as anyone kind of is aware of Tunisia, widespread antipathy towards the old party. And if there are free and fair elections with international monitors and so on, that the Tunisian people will kick the old remnants out, and there will be a new political leadership and so on. But the question is how to get us there, right? Whether there's going to be some kind of compromise that includes enough elements of the opposition, the previous opposition, and people with legitimacy, that the people, that the majority of Tunisians will have faith in this transitional period. Because, of course, an interim government doesn't do major things in many cases. I mean, they're not going to hopefully, you know, change Tunisia's basic trajectory. That's up to the new government that's established on the basis of genuine legitimacy and representation as a result of free and fair elections. There are other complicated questions having to do with the Tunisian constitution, a constitution that was amended a number of times by the Ben Ali regime to serve its own purposes, to limit who could establish political parties and who couldn't establish political parties. And so on. So there are those kinds of questions, too, and they're very, very complicated questions. But what we've seen with the continuing protesters on the street gives me faith that this revolution is not going to be stolen from the Tunisian people, because they seem to be set on getting rid of the old and turning a new page in Tunisian history, a page that includes representation, democratic elections, the recognition of human rights and civil liberties, and so on.
It's a big question, but I'm wondering briefly, you've referred to the impact on the differences of other regimes from the Tunisian regime. But what do you think has been up to now the impact of the Tunisian people's uprising on other regimes in North Africa and the Middle East at large?
Well, it really is an earthquake, and it's difficult for people who don't follow the region to understand how historic and significant it is. We have not seen previously an Arab regime or leader fall as a result of mass-based peaceful protests. The way Arab leaders, unfortunately, exit government is when they die or when they are removed as a result of a coup or a foreign military intervention. So it's historic and it's significant. It's had profound consequences. That doesn't necessarily mean that regimes are going to fall left and right as a result of Tunisia. But Tunisia is now a model for many in the Arab world. They look at the Tunisian experience as something that is hopeful, that they aspire to. We've seen this in throughout the region. And it's had consequences. There are demonstrations, increased demonstrations, shows of solidarity in front of the Tunisian embassies, protests in Cairo, Egypt, in Sana'a, Yemen, in Amman, Jordan. There have been opposition groups in a number of countries that have that have asked for, called for street protests and peaceful demonstrations against their regimes. We've seen a number of self-immolations in Mauritania, one, in Algeria, four, as Mohamed Bouazizi did in Tunisia, in another country, in Algeria, Mauritania, and Egypt, and so on. And we've seen the regimes respond to some extent by increasing basic subsidies on foodstuffs in Algeria, in Mauritania, in Libya, in Egypt, and in Jordan as a way to preempt some of the discontent and sources of the grievances. So this is an ongoing thing. It's not clear that, you know, the end product will be the domino effect of regimes falling. I'm not that optimistic, but it certainly has had an impact, both at the level of popular protest and feeling. The vast majority of people in the Arab world are thrilled at what has happened in Tunisia, and also an impact on regimes and how they have reacted.
Well, thank you very much for your insights, Samir.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye. I've been speaking with Samir Shahata. He's a professor of Arab politics at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies, Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. And today in Vancouver at 1 p.m. at the Vancouver Public Library, there's going to be a rally in support of democracy in Tunisia, organized by people originating from the Tunisian community now resident in Vancouver.